You're listening to the Fargo Podcast with Jeremiah and Mike.
Oh, yeah?
A podcast dedicated to the FX television show Fargo.
He says, is this what you want?
I think that, sir, is the sound of opportunity knocking.
So put that ice scraper down and enjoy the show.
There you go, now you see it. The inescapable reality. You're trapped.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike. My name is Jeremiah.
My name is Mike.
Hey, Mike, how's it going? Have you taken any bus rides, prison bus rides recently and ran into some old friends?
No, I wasn't on a bus ride. Yesterday at 6 p.m., I was eating dinner with my wife and dog. They can attest to that the entire time. There's nothing absolutely wrong with what I did yesterday, and there are multiple witnesses to be in accord with that. So that's all we're going to be talking about today. That's the podcast, everybody. Thank you so much.
Wow, Mike, slow down. I mean, nobody said anything about timing, and what are you talking about?
I got to go unwrap some gifts.
Hope you got a switchblade with you, because that's the only way you can do that.
I need a blue form to get to the gifts in the first place, so it's going to take me a little while.
But that requires a supervisor's signature, so I don't know if you're going to get that. So, man, Mike, it's good for me and you to be back here this week talking about another episode. Episode 7, The Law of Inevitability, which is, that's a mouth word for all that right there. Well, I just can't believe it. We've only got, like you said, a few more episodes after this. We go with three more after this. Oh my gosh, this is crazy.
Yeah, episode seven, The Wrench Awakens.
The Wrench Awakens, that's right. Yeah, that's of course the big thing I think a lot of fans were talking about. They were so excited to see Mr. Wrench back, which, you know, obviously I was fine with that. Me and you will probably dig a little bit into it because I think both of us tried to predict who from season one we would see. And I'm positive I'd have to go back and check our podcast, but pretty sure we did not have Mr. Wrench as a potential person coming back, right?
No, let's remember the last time we saw. Well, we've seen Mr. Wrench in different forms. It's actually pretty noteworthy that so far he's the only character to show up in all three seasons of Fargo in some way, shape, or form. If we're going in chronological order, season two, in one of the final scenes of that season, in the finale, there are two young boys playing baseball, and one of them is signing to another one. So you have to assume that those might be the childhood versions of Numbers and Wrench. Right. Hansi goes to defend them against some bullies, and you might assume from there, depending on what you think Hansi's future might be or who he might become, he gets sort of brought under his wing. He had his whole series of events with Numbers in Fargo season one that concluded with Mr. Numbers dying in the whiteout in episode six, I believe. And so it's left with Mr. Wrench. I think he was like handcuffed to a bed. Molly goes to see him briefly, and then Malvo goes to see him, gives him the key to the cuffs, and says, you know, I commend you. You two were the closest people have come to killing me. Of course, that will turn out not to be the case at the very end of the season when Gus Grimley ends up gunning him down. But he, like, gives him his card and says, feel free to contact me. So we don't really know between then and now what Mr. Wrench has been up to. Who knows if we're going to know, but it's been a while. It's been a while since we've seen an adult Mr. Wrench on Fargo.
Right. Maybe that should have been the giveaway for us when we were trying to decide which character from season one would reappear. Maybe we should have known. Maybe we should have guessed this. I don't know. I don't want to put ourselves down too much here, but yeah, just so now the question is, if they do a season four, which I know there's been some discussion about whether or not this is going to happen or not, but if they do a season four, should we just assume if Mr. Wrench survives this season that, you know, he'll probably be the one to come back?
Like, we could have, like, old man Mr. Wrench. Oh, and then season five will be all four versions of Mr. Wrench joining together to fight, I don't know, the robot overlords that are trying to come in.
Yeah, I like this idea. This is pretty good. Well, we can start jumping into this. So what did you think about this episode overall? I thought it was, you know, a good episode.
Yeah, I think from an eventful perspective, I think this and the previous episode have definitely notched things up. This idea of sort of the first half of the season was setting up dominoes. Now the first one has sort of been knocked over in the form of Nikki's beating. A bunch of events have transpired afterwards. Obviously, we had Ray's death last week. This week, no deaths, but, you know, we got Gloria circling this case further and further, much to the consternation of her boss. And we obviously have this moment at the end as well, where it seems like Varga's men are closing in on her, that we'll talk about whether or not, you know, what exactly their motives might be with Nikki at the end of the day. I mean, I definitely enjoyed it. Again, it was very tense, which these past couple episodes have really attributed to the season so far. It's also really interesting in that we see Varga at the very beginning and we have him in one other scene, but this is pretty much like a Varga-less episode. His fingerprints are not really on this episode, which is a little surprising considering I feel like David Thewlis has been in so much of specifically like the previous few episodes. It's been all about Varga bloviating. Personally, I'm a little happy to get sort of a breath of fresh air from his monologues. I love the performance, but sometimes it can grate on you a little bit, all of his big fantastical stories, to concentrate on other things. There were a couple of interesting scenes in here that we'll talk about that I'm not entirely sure click in terms of even the reality of the Fargoverse. But that being said, I was sufficiently entertained by this episode. What about you?
No, me too. And like you said, the tension has been building slowly. And I do feel like this episode, and I know there are some people out there that have talked about this, is that lots of gloom. You know, like you can tell things are starting to unravel for everyone almost really involved, outside of maybe, of course, Gloria and Winnie, who sort of things have, you know, Chief Mo is trying his hardest to unravel them, but they are pursuing this thing, you know, without a doubt. But everybody else, everything is really, things are just really going bad for everyone. And it's been fun to watch this as it takes place, because we know that the end is probably going to be, you know, pretty bad for most of these people. So I like that. I love building up the tension. That's what it's all about. And I think the last two or three episodes here are probably going to be pretty crazy. I'm sure we're probably for sure going to have to lose some more big characters very soon. So I love it. I love these episodes are just as important as the ones that have all the action, because that, you know, without having that great setup, it doesn't feel nearly as satisfying. So this was another good episode, and I really enjoyed it. Let's talk about this opening scene. What possessed, first of all, Varga wanting to open all of Stussy's gifts, but then with a knife? And as we see the final, one of the closing scenes with him and Emmett together, I don't know if you noticed, but it almost looked like he put the packages all back together again.
Either that, or this is like a flash forward and he does it after Emmett goes up to bed. But yeah, this is Varga.
That's true.
And then this is Varga at his grinchiest, which again, it makes sense in terms of his role in this show, in that you have the what's a somewhat serene, peaceful Whoville. There was still stuff bubbling with Ray and Emmett, but nothing that was, you know, accelerated along until Varga really came into the picture. And so here's the Grinch, kind of this outsider sneaking in and kind of ruining everyone's fun. I don't think, as you just alluded to, that everyone's going to join hands at the end and sing Haru Bore or whatever the song is and carve the roast beast, and that'll be that. It is interesting that he used a knife to cut open the packages. I don't know if I'm looking too far into this, but again, it speaks to this idea of, like, just like this episode, his fingerprints aren't really on anything. He's using a knife to open it instead of his hands, making very clean, precise cuts, which is the mayor that he works in, which is clean and precise. And of course, we can't ignore literally the bear in the room, the giant stuffed bear. We're going to get a lot of wolf symbology this episode, Jeremiah, but a little bit of bear symbology here as well.
Yeah, lots of bears. I mean, obviously, they went back to the Bear's Den restaurant, of course, where we had their dinner with Goldfarb, which I'm starting to think maybe, even though this is a fictitious restaurant, that in the Eden Valley area, but I get a feeling that in this world, it must be the finest dining available, because, you know, she definitely seems to like it. I don't know, is it her setting up these meetings or Sai, but one of these two really enjoy things at the Bear's Den. But yeah, I will admit, by the way, this opening scene, I don't know why I did not pick up or noticed the gigantic, large, stuffed bear that was in the Stussy's home. I'm assuming we have seen it before. Did I just gloss right over this thing or what?
No, it's a great question, because I had the exact same thought. Because we've seen the Stussy lobby many times. One of the first scenes from the first episode was them gathered in the living room or lobby or whatever you call it for that anniversary party. So it has to be there. But then again, it's maybe speaking towards this whole idea of how you might misremember things depending on our perceptions. Maybe there was a bear the entire time. Maybe there wasn't. Maybe the bear was named Berenstain. Maybe it was named Berenstain. I don't know entirely, but I'll have to take a look at it.
Okay. I feel a little bit better because, you know, they obviously pointed it out big time. And it was, the shot was right on it. And we see a couple times in this episode, and I'm thinking, wow, how did I miss this? I was feeling really stupid at the moment, but okay. And then, by the way, do we feel like, did it come across to you that Emmett did go through the back of the restaurant before he came in? Because I'm trying to remember now to the entrance to the restaurant, if we've seen it before. Because then, the more I second guess that, I did not have a chance to go back and watch the previous episodes where we got to see them meeting when Cy met with her. And I'm trying to remember if he did. I'm thinking he did not follow her, VM's instructions on how to come into the restaurant. What do you think?
Yeah, because the plan was what? That he told Emmett to come in through the back and say that he had been in the bathroom or something. I'm pretty sure that conversation didn't happen. So, I mean, Emmett's in a very different headspace than he usually would be during a meeting throughout the entire course of this episode, to put it mildly. So maybe he forgot Varga's instructions as well, had his own confused muddle alibi in his mind that was clouding all of his thoughts. Then he thought, all right, I'm just going to, you know, walk into the restaurant in a blusterly manner, sit down and let the mayhem ensue.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a lot of mayhem. Now, before we get to find out how terrible this dinner party goes, especially for Emmett, we did get this. So obviously Winnie and Gloria find out about Ray's death. We even start off by showing them investigating Ray's death, a body and all this stuff. And we get this scene, of course, where Chief Mo, we got to talk about Chief Mo, of course, interrogating Miss Nikki here. I tell you what, this guy, he's something else. I mean, I understand. Okay, we talked about the comparisons before with Bill from the first season, but Bill was kind of lovable. You know, Bob like played Bill in a lovable way, that even though he was an idiot, and you were like, oh my God, I can't believe he won't listen to Molly here. But this guy, you want to punch him in the face. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Do you feel like that? I mean, him and his stupid mashed potato theory, I swear to God, I don't want to punch this guy in the face, but what do you think? Mo's going to die, right? Please tell me this Chief Mo is doomed at some point, no, right?
I don't think Chief Mo is going to die, but I feel like...
Oh, stop it, Mike.
I know. I'm sorry. I wish we could draft him right now, but... you can add him. I know I'm ahead, but you can totally add him to your draft if you want to. No charge. But I feel like instead Mo's going to be in for his own reckoning that doesn't necessarily end in his own life ending. I think it'll be one of these things where he's like, oh, wow, you're actually right. And Gloria actually sets up this really interesting idea near the very end of the episode where, you know, Mo says like, oh, no, this is all about certainty about the whole security camera stuff. And Gloria says, I'm not talking about certainty. I'm saying there's doubt. And it's very interesting. And again, in this idea of truth and this truth theme that we keep getting throughout the course of this season to almost an exhausting extent, where Gloria's not necessarily saying it's your truth versus my truth. She's saying it's your truth versus my doubt that your truth is the truth. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's a completely different concept. And I feel like Mo isn't realizing that, and he's saying Occam's razor, simplest answer is simply the optimal one, it's the right one. But Gloria is sort of taking Occam's razor and making mincemeat out of that proposition and saying that, no, things are much more complicated than you initially realize. Of course, we know that she's right, but I'm totally with you. I don't want to hate Mo because it's sort of like the New York hipster me is saying like, well, the show just wants me to hate Mo, so I don't want to. No, you're not the boss of me, show dad. But I mean, the way that Mo is characterized thus far is so one note and a little over the top that you can't help but not hate him, especially when he's interrogating Nikki here and he has the whole, you know what, you know, mashed potato. You know what you got? Mashed potatoes. He's saying it's as simple as that, and he seems to be buying into the narrative that Varga was telling Emmett about, this whole idea of, oh, we can spin this like Nikki had killed Ray, suffering from this being this victim of abuse for so long. And it's interesting that, again, they're following the same sort of path there. Mo's buying it hook, line, and sinker. And I know we skipped briefly over Nikki's arrest, but a little bit of parallel to the movie and maybe the first season. I can't remember where. I believe Nikki was caught trying to climb out of a motel room bathroom window.
Right.
I believe that was Jerry Lundgaard as well, right? He finally got caught trying to climb out of the window.
Yeah, because there's been a lot of comparison too, by the way, about that hotel, about the motel being very similar to that and the movie. So yes, if I remember right, I know he tried to escape. Almost forgot about it. Yes, out the bathroom. I think you're absolutely right. Totally almost forgot about that. Oh man, poor Lester.
I think that Lester, I can't remember the end of season one. I believe Lester actually did successfully escape through the window.
That's correct.
And that's how he got on the snowmobile that eventually went through the ice.
Right. So in hindsight for him, because he was able to get out of that window, he winds up dead. Maybe by Nikki not making out the window, maybe she'll live. I don't know. But it doesn't really look very promising for her at this moment, especially now that VM's men have got her, right?
Yeah, I mean, we'll definitely talk about that. But who knows? We also see her watching a documentary in the beginning of this episode about the female millipede secreting cyanide to take out its enemies. Now, we saw an interesting syringe of some sort of liquid later on that was almost administered to Nikki. But there's the thought that maybe now that she's sort of been captured, Nikki's going to strike out against her captors and the people who killed the man that she loved by secreting her own form of cyanide.
Interesting. All right, yeah. We shall see. Now, obviously, Gloria and Winnie, they're not going to give up, even though the chief there at St. Cloud also was not very helpful at all.
Did you like how the chief of St. Cloud didn't even know who Winnie was? He's like, oh,
yes.
You're mine, right?
What do you do? Traffic stopping. Is that what it was? I mean, go back to doing that.
I feel like St. Cloud is obviously bigger than Eden Valley. I mean, I feel like, you know, a pond would be bigger than Eden Valley at this point in terms of coverage. But I mean, it's not great on the boss. I don't know if the boss is as new as Chief Mo, but bad on the boss for not even remembering who this person is, even by face.
Yeah, because you're absolutely right. This is not that big of a town. I mean, it's just obviously it's bigger than Eden Valley, but I'm just saying it's like he really had no idea who this person was. It was actually very, very comical. I don't mean to go back to the Mo thing. Let me close on last thing. Doing comparisons between, you know, Bill from season one and Mo, the motivation, the reason for being so almost to the point where it doesn't seem like they care is because for Bill, I think for Bill, he really just didn't want all the extra work. He seems like he was kind of a slacker. You know what I mean? It's like, oh man, I don't, you know, he just strikes me the kind of guy who didn't want to have to fill out any extra paperwork or doing like that. For Mo, though, this is more personal for him. He's getting ready to take over as chief in this town. And the last thing he wants is the previous chief to shine. So I feel like for him, this is more personal, which is even just as terrible. When you think about law enforcement not wanting to do their job for whatever reason, whether it's for, you know, spitefulness out of where Mo is at this point, or it's Bill just because he's a lazy ass. Either way, it's terrible, right? But don't you agree with this? I mean, it is because he cannot justify having this female chief, former chief of Eden Valley, show him up before he takes over officially, right?
It's interesting because there's a lot in that, and I'm not really being defensible of Mo because, again, I don't think there's much to defend of him at this point. But
right.
I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily rooted in that. I do feel like there is a part of Mo, and who knew that Chief Mo was such a deep character for being so one note. I think there's a part of like an inferiority complex in there. You know, when Gloria accuses Mo after that interview of like, you're not capable of nuance, and Mo says only an intellectual could be so stupid. Digging into that a little bit, you would wonder if maybe he sort of has this sort of, I don't know, idea in his head of like, okay, Gloria, you think you're smarter than me. You know, you think that I don't deserve my position as the chief. Well, I'm going to show you that this is the proper method. I think Mo just comes from whatever environment he may come from, you know, being a veteran as well might have something to do with it, where he believes, like, listen, my methods get results. This is my method, therefore it's going to get the proper result. I just don't think he can even fathom the idea that it's something else, which I think is something that him and Bill have in common. And I wouldn't say that Bill was lazy. I would say there was also part of Bill where I think Bill knew Lester too, right? So I think part of him was I can't believe someone I know would actually do this. So part of him was almost in denial about it. Moe's definitely in denial as well, but I feel like almost for a different reason. It's more him being obstinate.
Yeah, we talk a lot about the type of person that, or the type of people that they tried. Simple people, right? You know, with simple thinking, they don't overanalyze things. And I think that, you know, you get someone who questions things like, I don't know what you're... So I see what you're going with on this, because maybe it is more of just Mo being, you know, like, listen, this is the way it is. It's 1 + 1 = 2. It's mashed potatoes. It's... You know, you're overthinking this thing. It could be a little bit of that as well. Either way, it's very scary. Whatever the deep meaning reason for sure, or why Mo does not want to seem to listen to any kind of reason at all that's coming from Gloria, it's obviously terrifying. But
But I'm not going to defend, like, the end of the episode, for example, where he comes up with this cockamamie explanation that, ironically enough, is not the simplest explanation that, oh, yes, Nikki, you know, handcuffed herself purposely behind the bars and was trying to inject herself with this substance to frame somebody because she's a junkie. I think that's way too convoluted. We'll talk about the whole DJ Qualls scene of it all, which was so odd to me to begin with. But we're about to get into another odd scene as well, so it's a perfect segue.
Exactly. We'll close the chapter on Chief Mo, because I'm sure everyone's tired of us talking. I'm so sorry, everybody. I'm trying to dig deep into this guy.
This is probably his biggest episode so far, so I think we have a right to talk about him in a larger capacity than previously.
I guess so. But we don't need to dig into it any deeper. If you guys want to send me messages, we want to send me something on Twitter and talk about the... why Chief Mo is such an asshole, go for it. At Jay Panhorst on Twitter, I would love. We could go back and forth. That sounds great. So let's move on to this next very unusual scene, of course, is Donnie. Poor Donnie. You know, he's surfing on his BlackBerry, apparently checking out ladies.
Yeah, what was he? Because obviously Tinder did not exist back then, but that almost seemed like a 2010 version of Tinder, right? I mean, Jeremiah, you and I are both married. I think it suffices to say we have not had a lot of experience with those types of apps nowadays, right? But I feel like that stuff didn't exist in that capacity back in those days, right?
Yeah, I mean, 2010. So there definitely was dating sites, though. But, I mean, it's really hard to say. I was trying to figure out, like, if he maybe... was he, like, on a hot or not top? .com kind of thing.
Oh, I guess, yeah, hot or not was a thing back then. Yeah, that could totally
work. He did make comments like, oh, she's definitely out of your league or something. Something like that. He was mumbling things like that. So I don't quite know for sure. I just know that he was definitely checking out women online at some point. And God love him, we could tell very, you know, when you talk about a simple mind, Donnie is definitely, he's definitely one of them. He gets a phone call about some vandalism. He goes to leave. He leaves his gun in there, and he comes back and realizes the door's unlocked. He could tell somebody's in the building, and then he finds out that our man, Yuri, Mr. Wolf Mask guy, is sitting in there. I guess it looks like he really was reading that book, and I'm not quite sure if we figured out what book that was. I didn't chance to look to see, but he clearly was reading, and then we get this basically mind trick here that he does, which I wrote down in my notes. This, to me, felt exactly like, do you remember when Laura Mulvey gets pulled over by Russ Grimley in the first season, and how he basically tells him, you know, you don't want to pursue this, you want to get back in your car and drive away and pretend like nothing happened? It almost felt like Yuri was doing the exact same thing to Donnie. I mean, it really was what he did. He basically said, I'm not here, you go back to doing what you're doing. It was pretty wild, but I think that in fairness to Donnie, just like Gus, he made the right choice.
I mean, yeah, if it ended up with his life instead of being dead, yeah, then I think that was the right choice for him to make. I had the exact same thought as well. And from that perspective, you have to wonder, I wouldn't necessarily say it's trite at this point, but the fact that it's, you are sort of mimicking the same type of scene that you did so well in the first season isn't exactly lending lots of credit there to this idea that hopefully Noah Hawley's not running out of steam anytime soon. What I will say the key difference between the two scenes is that Malvo, when talking to Gus, seemed to more so, you know, be matter of fact with it, is saying, you know what, something, you know, if I were you, to be quite honest, I would just turn around and go. I think that's when he gives the whole speech about predators and camouflage. Right. Whereas here, Yuri is, in a Varga-like sense, definitely trying to spin a yarn and spin a false narrative for Donnie. He's saying, your eyes are lying. He jokes he's the ghost of Christmas past. So, again, in true Fargo season 3 fashion, things are a little more fantastical and a little more blown out, whereas opposed to in the first season, in that first episode, Malvo's a little more grounded with his explanation to Gus of why he should, you know, turn the other cheek.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. So, I mean, it definitely made for a very tense episode. Like, I was worried for Donnie. Until he started going into his little speech there where I realized, okay, maybe he's going to get out of this okay. But up until that point, I thought, oh, here's a goner. Here's somebody else they did not take in my death draft.
Well, to be fair, we did. I don't think we knew who Donnie was.
Oh, that's
the
a good point.
First episode.
That's
so
a good point.
I feel like if we do this, if there's a Fargo season 4, old Mr. Wrench, and we do this again, we might have to wait until like the second episode, just because we even have the emergence of a new character in the 7th episode. So Fargo does a fun job of dropping these characters in randomly, that it's tough to predict these things.
That's a good point. And I guess Yuri, he goes everywhere with that wolf mask thing, right?
Apparently. Yeah, I mean, maybe it was a way for him to hide himself when he broke in there, even though it seems like he left it on the car. So I'm not entirely sure if covering his identity is something he's really adamant about. Obviously, we're going to see the wolf mask play more of an importance later on. But yeah, I feel like something's got to happen with that wolf mask outside of him using it. Something's going to happen to it.
Yeah, I think you're right. It'd be very interesting to see what they wind up do with it. But it's very prominent. I mean, obviously, all this stuff ties in so nicely with the Peter and the wolf thing that we've talked about in a few episodes back. And
But I believe back then, Varga was the wolf and Yuri were the hunters. And maybe, if the hunters would wear the skin of the thing that they killed, I guess that would make sense with him wearing the wolf skin. But I believe in Peter and the wolf, Peter actually convinces them not to kill the wolf. So it's a little more muddled than initially thought.
It is more muddled than we thought. And I don't know if we mentioned that the first time when we saw that Yuri was the one that was hanging around with the wolf mask, because it obviously, you know, you're right, the show tried to portray Varga as the wolf, which of course makes perfect sense. He should be the wolf. But I just, you know, we'll see. It's muddled, like you said, but that's okay. He definitely loves this thing, and he carries it around. I don't know if maybe it was like a prized possession. Maybe he barehandedly killed this wolf or something, maybe.
Who knows what happened back in
the frozen tundra of Russia somewhere in Mother Russia. He was like rustling this. Do they have black wolves like that in Russia? I have no idea. But anyway, and he kills this thing with his bare hands, and I must carry this thing with me all around, so I never forget the time I almost lost my life as I get rid of this wolf coming talk to me.
Your Russian accent turned Australian for like a brief flip and then went back to the norm. You're like, oh,
we just lost all.
I wrestled the wolf and it escaped with my life, and then I took it back to the cabin.
It must be all that leftovers I was watching. You know, I've just been thinking
exactly.
A lot about
it's all mixed
Australia.
Together in your mind, yeah.
Man, actually, you know what it is? Is that way I can really tune in with both of our Russian listeners and the Australian listeners all at the same time, Mike. That's what I was going for.
You're land bridging the two communities into one, yeah. Jeremiah. Thank you.
That's just how I am. I like to bring the world together, Mike, as much as possible. Can we talk about this just disaster that happens at this dinner party? Wow. I mean, we knew, I had a feeling, Emmett, we knew he was going to be emotionally affected, obviously, by what had happened. But wow, not only did he really really screw up this meeting big time with Miss Goldfarb. But by the way, I have a lot to talk about with her because something's afoot here with her. But the thing is, I loved how I loved how the direction of the not only the cinematography, but obviously the decision on how to handle the scenes, especially when the when Officer Winnie comes to tell them about what had happened to Ray, and we basically get that just a sound of his heartbeat was just awesome. I loved how they did this whole thing, but man, he just destroys this whole thing. Oh my gosh! Right, Mike, go. What do you want to talk about? What do you think about?
Well,
this?
Well, I mean, I don't know. You would wonder, because I feel like almost instantaneously he would ruin it for them. But like you said, there might be something more to Goldfarb, because she doesn't necessarily get up and walk away. She doesn't say, "Okay, deal's off." She even says, "You reminded me of my husband." A bit, which right. actually might have put them in a better place than they were initially. But you have this really crazy exchange of Sai saying, you know, hey, if you love something, let it go. And then Goldfarb says, well, if it comes back to you, it's yours. And Emmett just says, if it doesn't, hunt it down and kill it. And I know that you said that Emmett would obviously be in an emotional place. I would expect him to be a little more forlorn and sad than angry and manic. Because, I mean, he is crazy at this point. Maybe it's just because everything is built up to a fever pitch. His wife has left him. His brother's dead. That Emmett has veritably snapped, but oh my goodness. And there's she notices the blood stain on his shirt. He talks about, you know, he puts everything out in the open saying like, oh, your husband died, mine left because of a fake sex tape. It's just, if he tried to really camouflage his alibi at all going into this dinner, the camouflage completely disappeared by like minute two of this conversation. And then I alluded to this in the very beginning of the podcast when Winnie comes to see them, like I said before, or like you just mentioned, Emma gets up and he doesn't even listen to see what she wants. He just immediately strings out this alibi that makes him look so, so guilty for anything and everything. And I mean, Emmett was crazy here, but the MVP of this scene was definitely Sai. It always is Sai, because Sai is just trying to like make it seem like Emmett is sane somehow, by being like, oh yeah, we talked about that, or it's a crazy weather, isn't it? It's just, you know, it's clear that this is one of the last strings that he has of right. actual sanity and being able to actually have something tangible to bring back to Emmett, and it very quickly snapped because of Emmett. So he's trying to really hold all the pieces in place as they're quickly drifting apart.
Yeah, I totally agree. You're right. I think not only this scene, but then even, you know, throughout the rest of the episode leading up to his breakdown with his wife. But I agree with you. Watching Sai try so desperately to keep things afloat and to keep, like you said, really covering as much as he can for Emmett was so fantastic. I mean, throughout this entire season, if there's one character for sure, we've talked about this many times, that you just can't help feel sorry for, it's got to be Sai. He's really working hard here for this. I mean, I just, oh my gosh. And then later on, of course, he gets Emmett, who's emotionally a wreck, starts to even try to blame him for all this stuff and thinking that maybe he was working with his brother. It is just, he's gone through so much, and I feel so bad for him, because that final scene, that final scene with him was so hard to watch. But I think you're right. I think that was one of the most enjoyable moments, was just seeing the expression in his face and seeing him try to go, oh, that's not, you know.
Yeah, or even later on, when, as you just mentioned, you know, Emmett and Sai start to really get into it. You can see the strains of their partnership showing, and Emmett, you know, in his heightened moment of paranoia, accuses Sai of joining up with Ray. Again, this is why Fargo has some fantastic writing of Sai being like, you think I'd work with that leptard brother and a syphilitic floozy? It's just, I love the term syphilitic floozy. It's this idea of really not so smart characters using really smart words, and just the dichotomy in that always makes for some fantastic humor, especially on this show.
Right, because it flows much better than, like, you know, using like herpes or something like that, right? Syphilis is definitely the one to go with.
Yeah,
you know, when you come in with a clever name,
the classiest, the real, it's the, you know, if herpes is the Tasty Freeze and Dairy Queen, and syphilis is the Bear's Den by comparison.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Yeah, exactly. All right, so can we talk about Miss Goldfarb? Because I'm telling you, so
give me your thoughts on her.
Okay, so at first you're thinking, well, maybe this might be the end. You know, like after this dinner didn't go very well, she's going to back out. Maybe this is the end. But no, I think there's something much more, because we've been wondering if there's another element going on behind the scenes that we're not quite aware of yet, that they're going to make aware of here as time goes on. And I'm wondering if she's involved in this. And granted, right now we could just do a lot of speculating as for sure as far as how deep she goes with this. But I'm starting to wonder if she's really got something going. Like, maybe not quite at the sinister level as VM is, but I start to wonder if she is almost kind of there. Right away, as soon as they leave the table, she's talking to someone on the phone. And it almost, she kind of alluded that she kind of knew a little bit of what's going on, and she was getting even more information for whoever this person was on the phone. Kind of like she was already tipped off about her, like she knew what they were discussing already about Ray's death. I think this girl is involved in a lot more than what we're led on to. And then we have this mysterious person that we've never seen before, played by DJ Qualls, how do you pronounce his last name? Qualls, okay. And we got this mysterious person who shows up that wants to take out Nikki. I'm not saying she's directly related to that particular person, but I'm starting to wonder if maybe she could be. I mean, I just what do you think? Am I overthinking this? Is she not as big a player as I'm thinking she could be? Because I'm starting to lean towards that she might be much larger to the overall picture than we thought.
I'd be hypocritical, Jeremiah, if I accuse you of overthinking things. That's what this podcast is all about. I'm not gonna take as big of a leap as you are, though. I do think that she has more of a significant role. I think the fact that she didn't outright say right there and then, again, deal's done, means that we're gonna see more of her. And you're right, this conversation that we overhear with her and someone else on the phone is super interesting, and she might have some connection to DJ Qualls' character, which we're going to talk about. But I don't know. I don't know if she's going to. I don't know if we're going to have, you know, an unmasking of, oh no, you thought Varga was the big bad. She was the big bad all along. I feel like she's more of a tertiary role in this season. But that being said, I think she has more of a role to play, because I do think this deal is somehow going to go through. And that, maybe that's going to reveal more of her. Who's to say? But I don't think this is the last we're going to see of her, no matter what.
Okay, yeah, I'm totally fine with that, because I think it was a huge mistake, obviously, for Emmett and Cy to, I guess we should put more blame on Cy, since Emmett's mind is not quite working right, and fairness aside, too, you know, he's trying to take care of Emmett and get him out of the building. I totally understand that, but they both left her just sitting at the table to get interviewed by Winnie. That cannot go very well for them, and, you know, because she could say whatever she wants to the police, and I'm sure we're going to find out.
She could talk to the cops. I mean, I'm sure Winnie is going to. Well, Winnie did go up to her.
Yeah,
afterwards,
yeah.
Right?
Can I talk to you?
And Goldfarb could have said right there, "Oh yeah, this guy was talking about a fake sex tape and was going on and on about the mantra, the vile maxim, and springing out all these things about the jackals in the darkness." And that would definitely be, I think, motive enough to bring him in for questioning.
Yeah. Well, we know things are unraveling for everyone, and it's definitely going to continue to unravel.
They're being slowly unwrapped, like a nice gift.
Yes, carefully unwrapped with a knife, and may or may not have been put back together again with tape. Who knows? But yes, the precision that you can get, by the way, with a knife. I'm sorry, I just so right on with that, by the way. Sorry. Okay. Well, we kind of glossed. We talked a little bit, but we wouldn't want to talk a whole lot about this scene with Emmett and Cy. But you know, I liked how Cy recovered so quickly with Emmett saying, "Listen, man, what is Varga telling you this stuff? I mean, I'm on your side." I feel like he brought Emmett back in there briefly. I don't know how much he's brought him back in, but a little bit there. I mean, they seem to kind of patch things up a little bit. Now, what's interesting is once Emmett goes inside, I thought Emmett's answer to Varga was very interesting, where he said, "How do you feel?" And he said, "Free." Mm, what are your thoughts about this? As you know, Varga, of course, goes into the rhyme, "There was a crook that his crooked man that his mother used to tell him when he couldn't have, wasn't able to sleep." if Emmett's feeling like he's free, I was at that point, I was kind of surprised he said that, because I didn't feel like that's where he was at mentally, but he said it.
I mean, you have to wonder, as emotionally volatile as he might be after his brother's death, that was really one of the big sticking points for him. Again, we talked last episode about the fact that Emmett was more angry at Ray, not because of everything that he had done for him, but because Ray didn't like him. And so I think maybe if that was the one big social weight that's now lifted off of Emmett's shoulders, he actually might feel pretty free, even though he's far from it, considering that the man that's directly controlling him is sitting on the stairs with him. And again, I know you pointed out the cinematography before, really fantastic shot mm-hmm. of that lobby with the two staircases, with Emmett sitting on one side and Vargas sitting on the other on the bottom step, almost like, you know, Emmett lost a brother, but he almost gained a veritable blood brother in Varga, and hopefully not too much blood will be spilled considering right. their new pact. But yeah, and going to this song as well, or this poem, this nursery rhyme, there was a crooked man and he walked a crooked mile. He found a crooked sixpence, pawned a crooked style. He bought a crooked cat, which caught a crooked mouse, and they all lived together in a little crooked house. Crooked is obviously the important adjective there. And it's very pertinent for Fargo and for the operation that Varga's running as well, considering that they are, you know, being inspected by the IRS, and Varga already has this plan to cook the books and have a crooked veneer to them. And I feel like, especially looking at the state of his teeth, Varga's life, his MO is essentially be the crooked man.
Yeah, he is definitely the crooked man, but this blood brotherhood, as you call it, which is perfectly what, like you said, the imagery that they're setting us up for is that this is going to be a bad brotherhood. Unlike, you know, he thought things were so terrible with Ray, but I think things are going to be much worse with this new brother of his in VM, because yes. he's leading him down a path in which is not going to work out very well for him. It's going to be pretty bad, and it's going to be tough to watch. Just like that scene we talked about already with Cy breaking down with his wife. Oh, man. Mm-hmm. That was...
Yeah.
Poor guy, right?
I mean, it was sad. I think he's probably the character I actually might have the most sympathy for at this point, just because he's done stupid things, you know, him trying to be the big man and hit Ray's car, you know, in the first couple of episodes. But that's all come crashing down around him. You see him for sort of the weak, vulnerable man that he is. And yeah, he sort of has this breakdown to his wife, and he says... You know, she says, "What's wrong, honey?" He goes, "Oh, the world is wrong. It looks like my world, but everything's different." He said that before in episode 5. You know, he says, "I feel as if I've left the known world, like I've stepped off the map into the unknown." So this is clearly something he's thought about for a long time. But to actually see him come to pieces in front of his wife, who has no idea what he's involved in about all of this, was so sweet, yet again, so funny. It was such like a dark punchline at the end of all this. Not a lot of hysterical moments in this episode, but this was definitely one of the funniest from a dark humor perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly was. I totally agree with that, because it felt bad to kind of laugh at it, but it's just because the way Michael did the whole thing.
Yeah.
And because the way Cy is as a character, you know, it was so well done, and I you're right. I couldn't help but laugh and feel sad all at the same time.
Yeah, it was really covering the gamut of emotions, which, to be fair, Emmett was pretty much doing when he was sitting down with the widow Goldfarb. So I guess Cy is now on that level, too, of emotional volatility.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we have two big scenes to talk about. Really want to dig into your thoughts about what we could be dealing with here with this mystery person who tried to take Nikki out. We have Gloria, of course, trying so desperately to interview Nikki. You know, she goes to, as we kind of talked jokingly about it at the top of the episode, but, you know, trying to get the right forms, you know, she's getting frustrated. But yet, then we have this scene where a person impersonating an officer, or is an officer, I don't know. He did get through the door, you know, which she couldn't, you know, accomplish. So he got through the door. Could be an inside job. We could talk about this a little bit. And he attempts to, you know, drug her. And I guess we're led to believe that it was going to be something lethal, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm assuming. Though it could have just been he had a syringe that had an air bubble in it, and you know, if you inject someone and put an air bubble into their bloodstream, once it reaches their heart, that they die.
Okay, right. So that's not good. You know, that's not good.
Either way, it's not very good. We don't exactly know what's in the syringe yet, but if someone walks into the precinct with a syringe planning to inject one of the biggest witnesses that's in your cells right now, you know it's nothing good.
Yeah, that's true. That's very good. So, theories. Now, I've already thrown out this crazy theory that maybe this person has some kind of ties with the Miss Goldfarb. Where do you think this guy come from? Because this, like you said, this really took me by surprise. In fact, all the way up until they purposely, of course, put him out of focus, mm-hmm. so you can't see who it is until he actually physically turns and looks at the camera. So we have no idea who this is until this happens. And now we're introduced.
Don't know who that is. We know the actor, but we don't. We're like, it's Hurley's friend from that one lost flashback episode, or the guy from The Man in the High Castle. But DJ Qualls has no part in the Fargoverse until now. So even the reveal was like, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, that's kind of the big thing is what I'm getting at. I mean, we've seen DJ's work. He has nothing to do with the Fargo universe. This is clearly a new character. That we are supposed to now learn. So the speculations are flying. What is your theories? I mean, like I said, I've already thrown out a pretty crazy one. Where are you leaning towards? Because obviously, this person wants Nikki out of the picture.
Yeah.
I know who it is. It's someone in the bridge community who says, damn it, I got to get her out of here. She's too damn good at bridge.
Oh, that's a good point. We haven't seen a lot of the bridge stuff. We know it's a very lethal, competitive community. What I will say is I don't know if I can make a prediction yet, but I can say what it's not. I don't think he's part of Varga's men.
Okay.
Because I feel like if he was, all we know about Varga is that it's him, it's Mimo, and it's Yuri.
Right.
We've seen no other people with Varga. Varga and these two guys have pretty much done everything from, you know, bugging the phone lines to flipping over a prison bus at the end of this episode. To introduce a new character right here, right now, would be really strange, especially since he's a cop. It could be possible, like, oh, they have a guy on the inside. But even then, you know, DJ Qualls was not necessarily, even though he does a pretty crazy kick to get Gloria's gun out of her hand, he puts a lot of guilt on himself or a lot of suspicion on himself on paper by just running out of the interrogation room like he's some sort of suspect. Though, of course, and again, I don't want to gripe too much about the reality of this universe because this is obviously a heightened universe. This is a true story, or this is a story wherever you want to take it. But I don't know. This idea that, you know, he attacks Gloria, he runs out of the room, Gloria shouts for someone, the cops pass him by, this guy sprinting, the other way in full speed, and instead go after Gloria, it just rings a little untrue to me. Not too much to, like, break me completely out of the reality of the scene, but it's a little bit of a quibble that I have, but that aside...
Well, in fairness, he is dressed as a police officer. So maybe
that's true, but if you had, you know, it's someone that you weren't used to, you didn't remember working with, even though he was dressed the same, like flop sweat down his face, running in the other direction from the place where someone is screaming help, you find that a little suspicious, right?
I'm with you. I am totally with.
Again, it's like a minor thing. It's things like this and the Yuri scene that, while I really enjoyed this episode, sort of stuck out to me is, you know, again, this show has not really been bound by real world conventions, but it's a little contrived a bit. But what I will say, again, going back to this character, and hopefully we find out more about him, hopefully this isn't just like this one time mystery character that we'll never know about.
We're gonna find out more, come on.
I wouldn't say I'm going full Goldfarb territory yet, but I don't think he's part of Varga's contingency, because we would have seen him at some point. If it was Varga's contingency, it would have been Mimo dressed up, because none of them know who Mimo is.
Yeah, it's clearly a third party. Which party is involved, we're not 100% sure just yet. You know, could it be some kind of rival against what VM is doing? You know, or something in that area?
We've never heard about him having a veritable rival before, and maybe it's something they'll bring up in the last three episodes, but It would be strange, but it would be intriguing because Varga at this point really does seem like the king of kings, the someone who really is not able to be brought down just because of his pure intelligence and cunning, though I'm sure it will eventually happen. It'll be interesting to see if suddenly a rival pops up that would be able to take him down.
Is there any kind of involvement with Innis Stussy? And because we spent a lot of time with his backstory, we went to California, you know, learn a little bit about him. I mean, is there some kind of ties there? Maybe.
I don't. Maybe it was someone who knows Maurice. Maybe Maurice has a deeper tie to the criminal community than we know. And there were rumblings that like Ray and Nikki killed. That's the thing as well, is that like it's not. If it was going after someone like Emmett or Ray, it would make sense if it was some sort of third party. But going after Nikki, I feel like is something different, you know, because Nikki is almost like a second degree of separation from all that.
Yeah, I mean, later on, we see Gloria trying her best to get something out of Nikki. Doesn't get a whole lot out of her other than just follow the money. You know, and this is, you know, this is always a great thing to say about any crime story. You know, you always want to follow the money because usually that does lead to the answers. I don't know how much this is going to help Gloria.
She could have been more specific though. And I know that Nikki was in a hard place because she's an ex-con as well. And
yeah,
I think she even talked about in the interrogation with Mo where she says, you know, oh, I've been through this before. I know I need a lawyer to be able to, you know, parse out everything. There's also something that we didn't talk about with Nikki. I think near the beginning of the episode when she's given the pictures of Ray's body. I don't know if you noticed this, Jeremiah. Nikki notices something in the picture that we're not privy to, but it seems like if she is alive at the end of this episode and she's going to go on this sort of Kill Bill revenge mission, this might be a clue that leads her in a certain direction.
Yeah, I know. I saw some people on Fargo or on Reddit discussing about that the picture. I personally don't know. I mean, she was intensely looking at something in the corner. Like maybe, you know, there's something there she was seeing that leads her to some conclusions on her own. But I don't quite know for sure yet what that is. But yeah, I mean, she, just going back, I mean, the question I'm still trying to figure out is, you know, who, if this third party wants her dead, exactly why do they want her dead?
Exactly.
That's the part that's kind of really messing with my mind, is I just don't understand, like, if they're trying to take a hit on someone important to this, like Gloria or Varga or Emmett or somebody where it really affects the transition of money going on between what VM setting up with the Stussy organization, or maybe the breaking up the cell with the company to Gold Farm. I'm just trying to figure out, how does Nikki, I mean, why, who cares about Nikki at this point? She's the girl who got set up. That's what's really like messing with me. So obviously this is something we could sit here forever and speculate about this, but I mean, I think it's definitely something that's going to be revealed to us very soon.
I would hope so, because, yeah, this is definitely one of the bigger question marks coming out of this episode. Because, again, you have to go back to your question of who cares about Nikki at this point. It's clear that Varga's men care about Nikki because she's a loose end, and it's clear that Gloria cares about Nikki because she feels like there's more to her. I mean, and Gloria's going to have this really actually very nice moment with Nikki at the end where her and Mo are almost sort of playing good cop, bad cop, in that Gloria says, like, all right, I'll talk to you when you're, you know, you're at the maximum penitentiary. What type of pie do you like? And that also just sort of shows how Mo and Gloria have definitely different ways of handling things, and how Gloria can sort of touch upon those emotional, more sentimental elements. But those seem to be the only two people on my radar who would pay attention to her. But like you're alluding to, maybe there are other parties that we don't know about who know much more things than we can initially think, and know exactly the role that Nikki plays in all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, would you... The last scene, of course, is this big moment where Nikki, of course, is Mo has, you know, released her on her parole, and she's going back to state. She's going to state prison, and she's being transported. It kind of reminded me a little bit of the great Harrison Ford movie, The Fugitive, where we have this distraction to the bus driver, and the bus, of course, crashes, and we find out, of course, Yuri and company are there to get Nikki. This makes sense that they are, like you said, they've got the files. They know what the police know now. They want to, you know, she's a loose end. I get why they're going after her. At this point now, you know, who else could be going after her? What reason? That of course, we need to find out. But what did you think? It was a great, dramatic, exciting scene. I mean, obviously now we're going to see how this plays out. We had the reveal of Mr. Wrench. Everybody's been talking about that. Russell Harper comes back to play that role. Whether or not we'll see anything from him in this upcoming episode, will he help her escape and keep out of the arms of Yuri and the men? I don't know. It'll be exciting to watch. Mm-hmm. Anything else that could come out of this scene where we get to see Nikki essentially being captured, it looks like, possibly?
Yeah, well, I want to get your thoughts, Jeremiah, in the moment. We talked before at the very beginning about, obviously, Mr. Wrench's cameo here, but I'll admit, and maybe it's just been a while since I've seen Fargo season one, but I definitely, when the camera panned out and it showed him, I thought, oh, this guy looks familiar. And I'll admit for a second, I thought it was Yuri under some sort of form of disguise, because I think him and Russell Harvard both have pretty hardened, stoic faces.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
I think under a wig, he could pass for it. But there was a specific tip off that I know you fell into, Jeremiah, that after a few seconds for me made me realize who exactly was sitting next to her on the bus.
Yeah, and it comes down to my television and movie score crazy love affair that I have, that I sit around and listen to scores on a regular basis. I listen to Jeff Russo's scores on both seasons so far of Fargo. The Numbers at Wrench theme is what you heard playing with the beautiful drums piece there that I just absolutely love. Every time I hear it, I just get, you can't help but get pumped up for it. Any of the listeners, of course, who've seen season one know that a lot of times when the two of them came on screen, that is the theme music that you got to hear. So that was a dead giveaway. Even if you're someone like yourself, Mike, who first looked at it and go, who the hell is that? And then when that music comes on, I think that was the, you know, the telltale sign. Oh, it's Mr. Wrench. The only person we, you know, believe had Cerrito obviously survived season one. So apparently, you know, with 6 years gone by, my guess is that, like you said at the top of the podcast, that Lauren Mulvaney did let him go. My guess is that, you know, who knows what he was up to the last 6 years, but apparently at some point here at this time frame, he finds himself back in the hands of the police. So I don't know what he's been up to, mm-hmm. but we all, of course, know he's not a good dude. He's a bad guy. He's been up to bad things, and, you know, it doesn't surprise me that he is, you know, being imprisoned.
Yeah, right? And what I will say about it is, you know, you were asking before, will Mr. Wrench help her? I think that it's not a coincidence that he's sitting next to her, and I think the way things are positioned, you know, with the bus flipping over, he's going to be right next to her. If they end up coming for her, I could totally see him. He's a pretty big, strong guy. I could see him throwing them off, at least enough for Nikki to escape.
Uh-huh,
now,
okay.
Are we looking at, like, I don't know, are we looking at a fugitive type of thing where, you know, you have Nikki and Wrench on the run? I'm not entirely sure. I'm not sure if we're going to have Mr. Wrench become a main character for these last three episodes. I could definitely see it, though. I feel like we got teased this season one cameo. If it was only for these 3 seconds, that would be a little bit of a buzzkill. I think that he has a thing at the beginning of the episode where he helps ward off Varga's men enough for Nikki to escape. Now we have Nikki on the run. And assumingly, you know, we have Yuri and Mimo are able to eventually overpower Wrench, maybe kill him. I'm not entirely sure. But that's what I think the limitations of his cameo are going to be, personally speaking.
It's funny because that's exactly what I'm visualizing as well, is that if we see anything more of him, it will be brief. It'll be at the beginning, and that's pretty much you know, all we'll have from him, which we say that now, and then you watch the writers are going to totally screw us up, and he'll be like a main figure for the last three episodes.
Yeah, turns out he was the one who hired DJ Qualls.
Yes, right, exactly. He was the kingpin that we didn't know about the whole time. It was always Mr. Wrench. Damn you, Mr. Wrench.
We should have suspected it the entire time. He should have been on our death draft. How do we not know?
Oh, if we only knew. Oh, my goodness. Oh, well. Well, I agree with you, though. I don't think we'll see much from him. It was cool to have him in there. It was, like I said earlier, it was definitely a dramatic, awesome scene, and I can't wait to see how it plays out. Because, you know, if they catch her right away, she's a goner, right? I mean, they're mm-hmm. not going to... They're only coming to get her for really bad reasons is the only thing I don't think they
they don't need information out of her, considering that Varga's now come up with this big grand narrative lie, and they can kill her and blame it on the bus crash. You know, I think that's one reason why they caused it. So they really don't need to get anything out of her in order to kidnap her, which makes me think, you know, Nikki has skirted death a couple of times at this point. You know, it was only through Ray. We talked about last week, the irony that Ray's death caused Nikki to live. She sort of is becoming a cat at this point. And actually, was she the cat in the Peter and the Wolf thing as well?
Yes, she was.
So she's got 9 lives, and I think she's gonna be able to survive once again. I feel like, much like Ray, Nikki's killing would be on screen. They wouldn't have a cliffhanger if they were just going to kill her at the top of the episode, in my opinion. Fargo has supplied expectations before, but I don't think that's going to happen.
100%, dude. You're absolutely right. There's no way they're going to kill her off screen. And I am, you know, a lot of people think, oh, you know, she's a goner now. I'm starting to think me taking Nikki in this death trap was really terrible, because I got this feeling now, the whole 9 live thing, especially that she was, you know, pointed out as being the cat. I would not be surprised at all at this point if she lives throughout the season. That's where I'm sitting at.
If she sort of becomes the Peggy, the one to sort of live through it and either reap the rewards or the disadvantages of it, I could absolutely see it. Because, yeah, unless she goes out in like a blaze of glory in the final episode, I feel like those are the only two outcomes for her. So, I mean, in retrospect, bad choice on your part. But then again, we both chose, you know, one of either Ray or Nikki to die, and I happen to luck out by having it be Ray.
I agree, but you know, you also have Sai, and I will be very surprised if Sai lives to this, although, again, it could be wrong as well with that, but I think you're winning this death draft, my friend.
Well, I'll make you the deal. If you want to take Chief Mo on for no cost whatsoever, I'm more than happy to throw him on there.
I don't like to set special rules. If I'm going to win this thing, I'm going to win straight out. I don't want to have to hold it over my head, go, yeah, of course, you know, I gave you Chief Mo, you know.
Yeah.
But no, I think you're right, though. There's no way that he's going to die. I mean, hopefully there'll be some kind of satisfying ending as far as, like, you know, he gets fired or something like that. That's kind of what I'm hoping for at this point, because I don't think he's going to die.
I could see him, you know, if and when this stuff gets resolved, he sort of hangs his hat up in shame and says, I'm going to go back to the army. I could totally see him doing that. He makes some sort of grand statement about how, you know, the army actually makes more sense than being a police chief in this day and age. I could totally see that conversation happening.
Me too. Absolutely. Now, I don't believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, we did not receive any feedback from either listeners, right?
No, not this week. I'm assuming that all of our listeners were on a prison bus that hopefully did not end up in any major accident.
Ooh, yeah, gosh, boy, I hope they all survived that, because, you know, we need as many listeners as possible, and I'd hate to hear that one of them, you know, tragically was injured, like, in a bus accident like that. That'd be terrible. But obviously, Mike, we would love to hear from our listeners, whether they email us or set us up on Twitter. However, we do get lots of conversations on Twitter. I mean, we recently had a listener, of course, fill us in about the truth of what's going on there in Eden Valley, which I think I alluded to that I could not find in my Google search for not only a Tasty Freeze but a Dairy Queen. But we had a listener, of course, Mike, tell us that they don't exist. Yeah. More false truths.
Who would have thought that this show would lie to us? And a show about lying and obscuring the truth, it would obscure the truth to us. But yeah, Thank you for pointing that out. As Jeremiah said, you can always reach out to us and let us know any of your thoughts about anything going on with Fargo, past, present, or future. We are on Twitter. Jeremiah is at jpanhorst. I am at a Mike Bloom type. If you want to send in long emails, longer than 140 characters, you can do that as well. FargoWithMJ@gmail.com. That's FargoWithMJ@gmail.com. If you're not yet, make sure you're subscribed to our Fargo only feed. Just search Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike on iTunes. And we're so appreciative of any ratings and reviews you may leave. Thank you so much to people who have left the kind words so far. We are really grateful about that. And if you are not subscribed to any of the other Jay and Jack shows, please do. There's a lot of stuff going on. I know I'm doing The Leftovers with Jay and Jack. Just finished up an insane penultimate episode. I know you haven't seen it yet, Jeremiah, so I will not go into any
spoilers.
But we are going to be covering the series finale. I cannot believe that this
series
is coming to a close so close. I mean, it's a truncated season, so I guess it makes sense. But we'll be talking that Monday about the finale. There's also The Broadcast. There's also The Merry Man Show. There's Owen and Beru's Barbecue, the new Star Wars podcast. There's a whole bevy of things to check out on the Jay and Jack Network. So make sure you're subscribed to the whole enchilada as well so you can enjoy all the goodness.
Absolutely. And consider becoming a patron. You know, if you really love what's going on around here, you know, show some love a little bit and, you know, throw a few dollars to the Jay and Jack Network. You can find it at patreon.com/Jay and Jack, I believe is the link, if I remember right, Mike. Mm-hmm. Does that sound correct? So,
I
yeah.
believe so.
You
yeah.
know,
and,
become,
and if you become,
become
a, if you become a, you become a patron, you get access to a special Facebook group in which, you know, you get to talk with us and other people and talk about, you know, content that you like to see on the network. There's a patrons only show that happens every month as well that the patrons vote on. So a lot of great exclusive content that's being put out there. So, yeah, you know, if you've been enjoying the content on Jay and Jack for years, the least you could do is give them a couple of bucks every month, money that you would not be able to spend at your Tasty Freeze Dairy Queen hybrid because it doesn't exist.
Yeah, and that's a tragedy, really. I mean, you know, if you don't have one of those nearby, whew, life's tough. Well, Mike, this has been a lot of fun breaking it down. I can't wait for me and you to, of course, next week talk about the episode 8. Well, we only have, like I said, 3 more episodes to go, and hopefully things will end up as exciting as we're expecting.
Yeah, I mean, things have, again, really ramped up in terms of tension the past couple of episodes. We have Nikki in a very precarious spot at the end of this episode, though it seems like she might have a possible ally in her corner. And we also have Emmett really coming apart at the seams. And I feel like those are the big two narratives that we're following, with some Gloria sprinkled in there as well. So I can't wait to see how this develops. And I can't wait even more to get to break it all down with you next week as we near towards the end of Fargo Season 3.
Yep, absolutely, my friend. So if we have nothing else to say, you take care, and until next week.